Hi, I'm Bob Massa, and welcome to today's reading of USA Today, and that is for Monday, April 8th, 2024. Start with a story called Reborn Dolls, eerie for some, healing for others, and David Oliver wrote the story. Two dozen lifelike babies nestled in a nursery in Tracy Knopp's home in Missouri. Except the cribs and bassinets aren't holding real babies, they're dolls. You may have come across these reborn dolls before. These are dolls artists designed to specifically resemble babies. The dolls look so real, it's almost scary. But before you write them off, you should know reborn dolls have proven therapeutic benefits, particularly for people with dementia. The dolls also could help people struggling with infertility or infant loss. James Beebe began bringing her dolls to dementia patients at local facilities in 2017. It's amazing that because you have a lot of these people who can't even tell you if they had breakfast that very morning, the Connecticut resident says, yet here they're telling you how big their baby was 60 years ago. It's incredible the memories that these dolls, really can unlock for some of these people. What started out as a volunteer work for Beebe became a business. She now brings her 32 babies, sometimes 8 at a time, to dementia patients across Connecticut and Massachusetts. Research backs it up, too. Doll therapy improves the emotional state of people with dementia, diminishes disruptive behaviors, and promotes communication, according to a 2022 study. The benefits may not stop at those with dementia. Knopp, for example, has a multiple chronic health conditions like severe osteoporosis and rheumatoid arthritis, as well as bipolar and general anxiety disorder, and has found the dolls bring her comfort, and they calm her down. When you hold a reborn, the realism and the artistry is one of the things that draws you, says Knopp, 60. Then they're weighted like a real baby, so when you're holding them, you get that. It's like that maternal instinct, and for me, that was comforting. Knopp's actual children and her husband support her hobby because they've seen how much it's helped her. Of course, not everyone supports the doll habit, particularly on social media. Some go out of their way to hide the habit in the first place. There are quite a few people in the doll community that are not accepted by the families or friends, Beebe says. They make up completely different social media profiles, so nobody knows they have these dolls. Knopp is open about her hobby. She picks a baby of the day to focus on and dresses up in baby clothes. She has 28 of them and two more on the way. Her dolls vary in size from a preemie, that's a few pounds, to one about the size of a 6 or 9 month old at 12.5 pounds. Some days she wants a heavier one to help with her anxiety, similar to a weighted blanket. To any naysayers, Knopp says nobody puts babies in a corner. It's to each their own, she says. You can have whatever opinion you want. It doesn't change the fact that if it's a benefit to you and it's something that you enjoy, don't let somebody else rain on your parade. Next, we have this. As Honduran worker who died in bridge collapse is found, family recalls his hard work in helping others. Eduardo Cuvez wrote the story. Maynor Zuzaza Sandoval is finally returning to the Honduras he sought to improve. For 2 years, the 38-year-old father of two worked not only to improve his family's life in Maryland, but also in his hometown, Azacupa, which he left nearly two decades ago. His life was cut short when a cargo vessel struck the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore in late March. The bridge where Suzal Nan Sandoval and seven other construction workers were fixing potholes collapsed into the Patapasco River. Only two people survived. Officials have worked to recover bodies ever since. Divers recovered Suzal Sandoval's body early Friday, the third to be recovered. At about 10:30 a.m., a unified command dive team found his body, officials said in a news release. Authorities met with Suzaza Sandoval's family to notify them that his body had been found. Relatives plan to return his body to his native Honduras, his brother Martin Souza told the USA Today in a phone call from his home country. Souza Sandoval lived in Owings Mills, Maryland. He is survived by his wife, a son of 18, and a daughter, 5. Souza Sandoval has 2 siblings in Maryland, along with the 5 siblings and his mother in Honduras. Souza Sandoval lived as a Cupa in western Honduras about 18 years ago, but never returned home because of his immigration status, his brother said. Described as a hard worker, Souza Sandoval labored to provide for his family and community in both the U.S. and Honduras. His brother says Souza Sandoval pushed his siblings to work hard and to create a family business. He wanted us to succeed as a family and then to help others who need it, Martin Souza said. That was one of his dreams. Next we got this. It says Israel withdraws most troops from Gaza. Egypt to host Hamas and Israel talks on ceasefire and release of hostages, and this was written by John Bacon. The Israeli military said Sunday that it had withdrawn most ground troops from the Gaza Strip after completing a withering offensive in the southern city of Khan Yunis, leaving just 1 brigade in the battled enclave 6 months after the war began. The military has been reducing its numbers in Gaza since the beginning of the year under growing global pressure to ease the impact of the war on civilians. The drawdown also has provided relief for reservists, many of whom have been away from their homes and jobs since Israel's offensive was launched within hours of the deadly Hamas-led assault on October 7th in Israel. The remaining Nahal Brigade includes a few thousand soldiers tasked with preventing Palestinians from returning to northern Gaza and carrying out precision strikes across the territory, the military said. It was not clear what effect, if any, the withdrawal would have on the long-threatened incursion into the southern Gaza city of Rafah. Let's take this next. It says, bracing for an active hurricane season. Experts see 23 named storms, of which 11 will be hurricanes. Diana Voles of Pulver and Doyle Rice, wrote this story. Buckle up and hunker down. An extremely active hurricane season is likely, top forecasters from Colorado State University announced Thursday. In fact, the forecast includes the highest number of hurricanes ever predicted in an April forecast by Colorado State since the team began releasing predictions in 1995. Colorado State hurricane forecaster Phil Klotzbach, author of the forecast, knows what the models show him about the hurricane season that starts on June 1st, but he is a bit incredulous it could really be that busy. We're coming out with a very aggressive forecast, 23 named storms, 11 hurricanes, and 5 major hurricanes, said Klotzbach, a senior research scientist in the Atmospheric Science Department at Colorado State. And even that is so undercutting all the model guidance. Everything is leaning toward an extremely active season, still record warm Atlantic water temperatures, and a pretty rapid transition over to La Nina, he said. A typical year averages about 14 tropical storms, 7 of them spinning into hurricanes, based on weather records that date from 1991 to 2020. The forecast covers storms that form in the Atlantic Basin, which includes the Caribbean Sea and the Gulf of Mexico. The seasonal forecast models have little to do with where hurricanes hit land. Tropical storms and hurricanes are steered around in part by high-pressure ridges set up over the ocean. La Nina, however, tends to allow more hurricanes to move more westward across the Atlantic rather than peeling off to the north as they approach the islands in the far eastern Caribbean, Klotzbach said. that favors hurricane landfalls along the East Coast from Florida to Maine, and more toward Florida and Texas and Alabama. Klotzbach expects to see La Nina conditions appear over the next couple of months. In a typical climate pattern, La Nina leads to more activity in the Atlantic region because the lighter winds in the upper atmosphere allow hurricanes to build up the powerful cloud tops that give them their oomph, while El Nino drops in winds over the Atlantic that work against these high cloud tops. But lately, things over the Atlantic Ocean have been anything but typical. Despite the El Nino last year, the Atlantic produced 7 hurricanes, average for a typical season. Moving over to money, we're going to start with this story that says, study finds biases among chatbots. Black, white-sounding names treated differently. Planning to turn to a chatbot for advice? A new study warns that its answers may vary based on how black the username sounds. A recent paper from researchers at Stanford Law School found significant disparities across names associated with race and gender. From chatbots such as OpenAI's, ChatGPT-4 and Google AI's, and Palm-2. For example, a chatbot may say a job candidate with a name like Tamika should be offered a $79,375 salary as a lawyer, but switching the name to something like Todd boosts the suggested salary to $82,485. The authors highlight the risks behind these biases, especially as businesses incorporate artificial intelligence into their daily operations, both internationally and through customer-facing chatbots. Companies put a lot of effort into coming up with guardrails for the model, Stanford Law School professor Julian Narco said, one of the study's co-authors, told him USA Today. But it's pretty easy to find situations in which the guardrails don't work and the models can act in a biased way. A paper published last month asked the AI chatbot for advice on 5 different scenarios to discern potential stereotypes. And they were, 1, purchases, questions on how much to spend when purchasing a house, bike, or car, chess, questions on a player's odds of winning a match, and public office, asking for predictions on a candidate's chance of winning an election, sports, asking for input on how high to rank a player in a list of 100 athletes, and finally hiring, asking for advice on how big of a salary to offer a job candidate. Study found most scenarios displayed biases that were disadvantages to black people and women. The only consistent exception was when asked for input on an athlete's position as a basketball player. In this scenario, the biases were in favor of black athletes. The findings suggest that all the AI models encode common stereotypes based on the data they are trained on, which influences their response. Paper points out that unlike previous studies, this research was done via an audit analysis, which is designed to measure the level of bias in different domains of society, like housing and employment. Narco said the research was inspired by similar analyses, like the famous 2003 study, where researchers looked into hiring biases by submitting the same resume under both black and white-sounding names and found significant discrimination against black-sounding names. In the AI study, researchers would repeatedly pose questions to chatbots like OpenAI's, GPT-4, GPT-3.5, and Google AI's Palm-2, changing only the names referenced in the query. Researchers used white male-sounding names like Dustin and Scott, white female-sounding names like Claire and Abigail, black male-sounding names such as Daquan and Jamil, and black female-sounding names such as Johnny and Kenya. The AI chatbot's advice, according to the findings, systemically disadvantages names that are commonly associated with racial minorities and women with names associated with black women receiving the least advantageous outcomes. Researchers found that biases were consistent across 42 prompt templates in several AI models, indicating a systemic issue. An email statement from OpenAI said bias is an important industry-wide problem that its safety team is working to combat. We are continuously iterating on models to improve performance, reduce bias, and mitigate harmful outputs, the statement reads. Google did not respond to a request for comment. Next, we got this. A survey finds singles prefer LinkedIn to find love, according to Anthony Robeldo. Tinder and Hinge may have met their match. LinkedIn and other networking platforms are a preferred way to set up dates over popular dating apps like Bumble, according to a survey of singles by DatingNews.com. Networking sites are the popular dating method for single people between 25 and 40, the survey of 505 people actively dating found. While LinkedIn connects businesses with employees and professionals with other professionals, plenty of romance is bubbling under the surface that you probably don't see, the report said. Around 61% of participants in the 35 to 40 age group said they prefer LinkedIn-like apps over the other dating processes, including blind dates, 54%, social activity, 45%, dating websites, 50%, bars or clubs, 44%, and cafes, stores, or restaurants, 41%. It's also the most popular dating method for the 25 to 34 age group at 49%. Meeting someone at a bar or club is the most preferred method for the youngest demographic ages of 20 to 24 at 52%, with only 47% saying networking platforms tied with social events. Old school daters can find relief in knowing blind dates are not a thing of the past. Nearly half, 48%, the survey participants said, they have been on a blind date arranged by a friend or a family member. This method is most popular for those 35 to 40 at 54%. People might prefer to go on a date set up by someone who knows them as well, as opposed to using date apps that are often a shot in the dark, the report said. The survey also shared some less common and perhaps creative ways to put yourself out there. The report shared the following methods that led to future dates. Starting with work events, 33%, gym or fitness centers, 31%, sports clubs, 30%, sexuality exclusive apps, 26%, commuting or travel, 26%, luxury dating apps, 25%, and finally, social media apps, 24%. Next, we got this that says 99 cents only stores to close all locations amid the financial woes. Anthony Robadello wrote this story. After more than four decades in business, 99 cents only stores will close all its doors permanently. The retail chain, once known for its below $1 prices, has announced the closure of all 371 locations. This was an extremely difficult decision and is not the outcome we expected or hoped to achieve, interim CEO Mike Simonic said in a news release Thursday. Unfortunately, the last several years have presented significant and lasting challenges in the retail environment. Simonic said several factors contributed to the dire state of the discount store company, including the unprecedented impact left by COVID-19 pandemic. He also cited shifting consumer demands, inflationary pressures, and rising shrinkage levels, which refers to the loss of inventory or cash from theft, damage, or administrative errors. We deeply appreciate the dedicated employees, customers, partners, and communities who have collectively supported 99 cents only stores for decades, Simonic said. The company has not provided a timeline for the closure of its stores across the U.S. or said how many employees would be losing their jobs. Executives worked with financial and legal advisors to find a credible alternative to mass closures, but could not reach a solution, according to the news release. The company ultimately determined that an orderly wind down was necessary and the best way to maximize the value of 99 Cents Only Store assets, the company said. The company was founded in 1982, offering guests a combination of closed-out branded merchandise, general merchandise, and fresh foods initially offered at 99 cents or less. All right, now we're heading into sports, and we're going to start with the big story of the day. Actually, will push come to shove? Purdue looks to take down defending UConn. Dan Wolkin wrote the story. It is, in fact, possible to make UConn sweat. The last question to be answered before the 2023-24 men's college basketball season wraps up is whether Purdue can make them bleed. To this point, nobody has in 2 years of NCAA men's tournament games. 11 opponents up, 11 down, all vanquished by double digits. It's incredible. It's unprecedented. In an event defined by unpredictability, it defies all logic. We make a hard tournament look easy, Connecticut coach Dan Hurley said a few minutes after his team vanquished Alabama from the Final Four, 86-72 on Saturday. It's crazy. But is it inevitable? Alabama gave UConn its stiffest test of the tournament, which may not be saying much when the Crimson Tide ended up on the wrong end of a 2-touchdown margin. But unlike UConn's other opponents in the last couple of years of tournament romps, this was a real basketball game. Alabama's three-point marksmanship and the athleticism of its guards gave UConn some things to worry about. Had one of the two guys gone differently around the nine-minute mark when Alabama was going blow for a nice stretch, maybe it's a different game. Maybe the pressure of a possession-by-possession battle down the stretch rattles UConn's nerves. Maybe it's the outside shooting goes cold at the wrong time. Maybe. The trick for UConn is the Huskies never allow us or their opponents to find out. They're close to being bulletproof, Alabama coach Nate Oates said. What Oates' teams did Saturday was really, really good. To beat UConn, though, requires one more level of 40-minute greatness, and you better believe it's going to take all 40 minutes. That's where Purdue enters the picture on Monday night at 9:20 on TBS. Had you turned into a college at any point in November, December, January, or February, you could have reliably predicted that these two teams playing for the national title, because they have been this good from the start to finish. Other contenders came into the picture at one point or another, sure, but the contours of this season were always pointing to these two. Purdue had the best player in Zach Eddy with a supporting cast that was a year older, a year better, and a year more determined to break through the Final Four. UConn had incredible depth, unmatched offensive execution, and a coach who would not let them relax for even a moment, as the expectation built that they would become the first back-to-back champion since Florida in 2006 and 2007. He never let the right-turners get complacent with what happened last year, UConn forward Alex Caravan said. There's no let-off. The Alabama game showed that it's possible to hang with UConn. It's also showed why it's going to be difficult for anyone, Purdue included, to actually finish the job. With 12:41 remaining, this was a tie ball game. Alabama was making things fast and chaotic and swarming the paint defensively and hitting threes at close to a 70% clip. And then, 8 consecutive UConn points in a little more than 2 minutes. Then there comes Alabama again with point guard Mark Sears getting downhill and finishing tough shots to get things back in the nervous zone, for UConn. Guess how they respond? 2 possessions in a row that end with a second-chance buckets. Against UConn, the moment you feel like you have a chance tends to get away before you even realize it's gone. The feeling with the group is that its body blows, continue to guard, continue to rebound, execute our offense, and eventually there will be a breaking point opportunity that will present itself, Hurley said. We may not break you for 18 or 25 minutes, but at some point, if what we're doing is at a high level, it just becomes hard for the other team to sustain it. Often in the NCAA tournament, all the upsets leave us with a championship game that looks like a mismatch on paper and usually plays out that way on the court, too. Not the case this time. From so many angles, including scoring, defending, rebounding, and overall depth, there's just not much between them. It has a chance to be fabulous. UConn, though, has a way of making these games a lot less fabulous than they should be. We just try to stay true to our identity, Caravan said. It's something the coaching staff preaches every day. If we focus on defense and rebounding, everything else will go our way. We'll pass up good shots for great shots because we have so much trust with each other. Formula has been good for 11 consecutive NCAA tournament blowouts, and now only Purdue stands between the Huskies and the greatest two-year possession season run in the history of the sport. Now we'll look at the women's side, and it says refereeing stepped behind pace of the women's game, according to Nancy Armour. The officials just couldn't help themselves. Caitlin Clark in Iowa, Paige Beckers in UConn, the team battling in a prize fight worthy of a game, a spot in the national championship game on the line, and the refs had to go and make it about them. After a season's worth of bad calls, inconsistency, and a lack of transparency, the end of what was a spectacular game Friday night was marred by an offensive foul call with the last 3 seconds left and UConn trailing 70-69. Whether it was the right call or not, replays did show Aaliyah Edwards threw her elbow at Gabby Marshall on the screen re-screen, and her stance was considerably wider and her shoulders, which is not allowed, is largely irrelevant. Players played a game. They should get the chance to decide it, too. Instead, the refs inserted themselves, and now that's all anyone will remember about this tremendous night of basketball. Not Hannah Stuckey's statement performance, not Kate Martin making one big shot after another, despite probably having broken her nose yet again. Not UConn going toe-to-toe with college basketball's all-time leading scorer and the country's highest-scoring team, despite being held together with duct tape and glue, the call. Everybody can make a big deal of that one single play, but not one single play wins a basketball game or loses a basketball game, Bucker said. I feel there was a lot of mistakes that I made that could have prevented that play from even being that big. So you can look at one play and say, oh, that killed us or that hurt us, but we should have done for refusing to blame the call for their loss. That's it for today's reading of USA Today. And I've been reading from the Monday, April 8th, 2024 issue. If you have any questions about the articles I've read, please call the Chris listener line at 860-727-9579. And I'm Bob Massa, and so long until the next time.